Hello and welcome to Coffeehouse Shots, Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm John Connolly and I'm joined today by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. Now, in a sign that the government is getting ready to flex its muscles and start its domestic agenda, the Home Office announced today that it's going to introduce a new terror bill, which will, I think, start in Parliament around March. The bill plans to increase the sentences for terrorists and also make, when they release, the conditions placed upon them much stricter. Now, Katie, this is one of the sort of the first pieces of legislation we've seen in the new year. Do you think this is a big sign that law and order is going to be a big focus of the government?
Yeah, and I think it's what we were led to expect from the election campaign and from everything Boris Johnson was really saying since entering Downing Street, even when he didn't have a majority and he couldn't really do much. It was quite clear that if you look at the areas this government would have wanted to focus on, yes, Brexit, but again, not to utter it for the umpteenth time, get Brexit done. The point was so you could talk about other things. And I think when you look at those domestic priorities, the NHS and law and order are at the top of that agenda. Now, education also comes in, levelling up the country, you know, the government phrase also comes into that. But I do think if you're just looking at specific domestic policy areas, NHS, law and order. And what's interesting is it feels as though lots of people have been surprised by some of the things this government has done, such as perhaps the flyby intervention last week. There's been comparisons already between Boris Johnson and Tony Blair. But I do think the one area where you can say this government has moved to the right and is happy to say they have is on crime. And you can see that in lots of the things that are going to be included in this. So, you know, the new minimum jail term, longer sentences, this idea of one thing they're talking about were more prison places. If you come from a liberal approach to this, people will say, less focus on punishment, we should be focusing on how you reform people. Whereas I think that all this takes the line of a tougher system in there.
I mean, James, if you look at some of the things like lie detectors, do you get the sense that some of the proposals being put forward are a bit more to do with theatrics and sort of symbolising you're being tough on crime rather than actually doing sort of more tangible things to it?
I think it's worth rewinding for a second here, which we had a remarkable kind of failure of public policy, which is we had a terrorist attack committed in London by a terrorist who had been let out of prison on the basis that he had reformed. And I think that requires you to examine how that happened. And I think that there was a clear mistake made in that case, unarguably. And I think there is a problem here, and this applies not just to terrorist offenders. There is a sense that if you say the right things, people, because of the stresses on the prison population, people want to say, okay, fine, off you go. And I think that is a challenge. I think in all this stuff, which is, again, Katie's point about rehabilitation, it's very hard to rehabilitate people in an overcrowded prison. So if you're going to have overcrowded prisons, you're not going to achieve very much successful rehabilitation. So weirdly enough, if you actually want to rehabilitate people, you need more prison places, because you're not going to do that in a cramped prison where the prison officers are struggling to keep order. I think there are also kind of real problems with terrorists within prison. We had, you know, there are clearly, as the recent assault in a prison, Ian Anderson, who conducted a review on this, has said, you know, suggests that there are clearly kind of terrorist activity within prisons. And so I think you do need to look at all of this stuff. And I think you need to start from a premise of public protection when it comes to terrorism. And I think, you know, it is just worth remembering, you know, thanks to the bravery and the courage of people on the scene, London Bridge did not turn out to be as bad as it could have been. But that was a remarkable failure of public policy and something that needs to be dealt with.
I mean, as well, it's probably worth bringing up, suggesting that the government isn't starting from a blank space. It almost seems to be undoing the last government's rather shaky reputation for law and order. I mean, this is not to suggest that, for example, police cuts or numbers would have affected something like the London Bridge attack, but do you think there will be a movement in this government to sort of reverse that and increase the number of police officers and that kind of thing?
In the last government, if you look at the people who followed Theresa May into the Home Office, there was this frustration that when they wanted to change things in the Home Office, they were often blocked or stopped from doing so because Theresa May was Prime Minister and she wanted to protect her legacy. And there was a sense that on issues like police numbers and funding, it was one area where it wasn't a particularly strong centre, it was a very shaky government, but where they would step in would be on Home Office issues, because Theresa May felt very strongly that what had worked for her during her tenure in the Home Office should work in the future. And I think that lots of people found that very constraining. That is not an issue now. And again, you saw that because Boris Johnson feels no need to protect Theresa May's Home Office legacy. And that's why you are seeing the promise of, you know, more police and, you know, and you're moving away from the point where you had with Theresa May. And there's quite awful interviews she did where, you know, so she said they're not linked, police numbers and rates of crime. I think that one of the things this government is very good at is disowning itself from things the Conservative governments have done, despite the fact that the Tories have been in power for such a long time. In the election, they managed to suggest that actually this was a new government, and it seemed to work very well. Boris Johnson distanced himself from austerity. So again, I think that they feel the need to regain their reputation as a party of law and order. And I think they're very happy to put clear blue water between what this government is doing, what Theresa May did.
Early on in Boris Johnson's premiership as well, James, there's maybe perhaps suggestions that there might be a conflict between Priti Patel and Boris Johnson's One Nationism. Do you think they're pretty much singing from the same hymn sheet now, or is that always slightly misplaced?
Because I remember having a long conversation with someone who knows both Boris Johnson and David Cameron very well. And we were talking about where they sit on the political spectrum. And their view was that the one issue on which Boris Johnson was more right-wing than David Cameron, and always has been, is crime. Boris Johnson is not a hug-a-hoodie conservative. He is a much more of a kind of... He's much tougher on law and order than that, and always has been. He is a kind of... It's kind of part of his kind of, like, you could call it kind of saloon bar conservatism, that you know, he is instinctively tougher on those questions than, say, a Cameron was. So I think, you know, when he made Priti Patel Home Secretary, he knew precisely what he was doing. This was a deliberate move designed to try and get the Tory party's reputation as the party of law and order back. And, you know, you saw two prongs to that. One was to try and neutralise the police numbers thing by basically promising to recruit 20,000 more police, which is essentially, as Katie was saying, essentially a reversal of what had been done under Theresa May. And then the second was more powers for the police, believing that, you know, that was something where Corbyn would not be able to, or would not want to match the Tories. So I think you do see that they are in this, you know, that this is going to be a government that's going to be kind of unashamedly tough on law and order. And it's also worth remembering, you know, a lot of this government, you know, is a tribute to Tony Blair. You know, almost every year in the New Labour era, there was a new criminal justice bill which increased sentences, which took tougher action on antisocial behaviour. Because, you know, if you are a government that listens to focus groups a lot, this is one of the things you will always hear.
So expect to hear more, perhaps. Moving on to other battlefields, yesterday, Tony Hall of the BBC, the Director General, announced that he was stepping down in the summer to be replaced. It's fair to say, Katie, I think this is probably quite an interesting time for the BBC and quite a significant time for him to leave.
Yes, and there are lots of people who think the BBC is under threat. I think that the BBC as it currently works and is formed and its future is a matter of debate now. And it's quite clear that this government takes a sceptical approach when it comes to what the BBC should be doing next. Now, we've heard that one thing they're looking at is the decriminalisation of whether or not you have a TV licence. And I think that Director General is the post where the government will take an active interest, and they have a role in who is going to be the next Director General and who that candidate will be. And already you're hearing lots of Tory MPs with their own ideas. I think that ultimately what the BBC needs to work out, however, is it likely that they're going to have a licence fee and one that the government supports in the long haul in the future? Or are they going to have to start thinking about new models which are more in sync with how technology is evolving, how are streaming services? And I think that's probably the existential problem for the BBC. And I think that this government is very happy to raise those questions and try and move away. And I do think there are different things here. So people focus on the fact that there is a boycott, you know, by Downing Street of various ministers on certain shows. So for example, you don't get ministers on the Today programme these days. I think that, yes, figures inside this government are heavily critical of the BBC's election coverage, but I still think that lots of the questions around how the BBC should operate in the future are about funding models and what the BBC is providing rather than because they didn't like the way an interview was programmed. So I think it's easy to almost think it's more of a caricature attack than I think
it's not a revenge killing kind of
thing. Yeah, I think lots of people in the Conservative Party, who look at figures like John Whittingdale, who have long taken issue with the way the BBC work. Now, bias and perceived bias is clearly a part of that, but I think they're also just genuine questions about the role of the BBC in an environment where lots of people no longer watch television from a TV. They watch it on their laptops. They, you know, pay for various subscription services. And I think that's actually probably the bigger issue.
James, as Katie says, like, the government's expressed sort of a clear preference for the way they would like the BBC to be run in future. How much sort of authority do they have over this decision to replace Tony Hall, or is it?
I mean, this is one of the reasons why Tony Hall has gone now, because the governor general, not governor general, David Clementi's role as kind of at the BBC, that is a government appointment, right?
And it's the person who chooses
the DG. So basically, his term comes to an end, I think, in the next year or so. And so, if he had gone, you would have been in a position where the government could have picked someone, knowing that who they would have then picked as director general of the BBC. I mean, that is one of the reasons why Tony Hall, why the sequencing has been as it is. I mean, the problem, one of the big challenges to the BBC is it can't resist kind of mission creep. I mean, if you go and look at the BBC website now, which is a phenomenal resource, it does a lot of stuff that would be done commercially. And it also moves into lots of places where people were making money. The BBC starts doing similar things. Like, you know, if you compare the BBC website to what it is today, to what it was, say, 5 years ago, it has more BuzzFeed-y style, five things about this, and that, all that kind of stuff. And I think there is a question that the BBC can't resist crowding out. I also think that the BBC sometimes can't resist chasing ratings, you know, doing stuff that would maybe could just as successfully be done by commercial broadcasters. And I think that is a challenge. I think the kind of it's finding the justification, I think, for the BBC should be to do things that the market would not otherwise provide. And that means, you know, taking kind of creative risks in a way that the market would not be willing to do so. Or that means providing kind of, you know, particular programming, you know, catering to niche audiences that the market wouldn't provide, you know, whether that is, you know, Welsh language programming or kind of classical music, you know, all that, you know, lots of things like that. And I think the problem with the BBC is it just can't resist trying to do too much. I mean, that is always, and that is a mindset challenge for the BBC that it needs to kind of adjust to. You look at, you know, if you look at the prime time schedules, how often the BBC appears to be scheduling against its commercial rivals, which I think is, you know, is very dubious when you consider how the ways in which the BBC is funded.
And last of all, Katie, how are things going on with the Labour leadership contest?
So it's a crunch week in terms of union endorsements. Keir Starmer has now secured enough support that he is through to the final round, the membership round, as though the union has backed him. And now he still could get union support. There are other unions deciding. The big one that everyone is watching today is GMB. And I think this is an interesting one because Keir Starmer is assured, we expect Rebecca Longbody to get the Unite endorsement later this week. What about Lisa Nandy? If Lisa Nandy can get union support, then there's clear route. If she fails to get this endorsement, then I think that you start to get to a point where it's hard to see how she gets to the membership. Right now, the CLP route, which is constituency Labour parties backing you, is not, although lots haven't declared yet, you don't get the sense that any of the three candidates, in the sense of Lisa Nandy, Emily Thornberry and Jess Phillips, are gaining too much momentum there. Emily Thornberry has had a couple, but you've got to get over 30, and I think that that's looking like a stretch. So I think all eyes is basically, can Lisa Nandy get union support? We suspect that she may be able to get another affiliate group, so she can do that, she gets through. And if she can't, are we heading to a two-horse race in terms of the final round?
And does Keir Starmer get a bit of an advantage here, James, now that he can just focus on the members, or is it a tenuous one?
I think Keir Starmer is running a good campaign in that, I think, you know, he is running a good campaign for this contest. He pitched himself to the left quite cleverly in his opening video. I think he is also benefiting from the fact that, you know, Rebecca Long-Bailey appears to be a candidate who is being run rather than running. I mean, that explains some of the problems with her campaign. And meanwhile, we Lisa and Andy is the closest to it, but we haven't had a kind of breakout candidate yet. I mean, and again, ironically, I think that when the kind of Corbynite faction on the NEC, to be extent, the current hustings rules are essentially a front runner stitch up, right? Only 40 seconds to answer a point, right? That's designed to benefit the front runner. Now it looks to me, and looking at the accumulated polling evidence, it's not quite as definitive as some people like to suggest. But it looks to me like Keir Starmer is the front runner. So ironically, all these rules, which were designed to prevent any drama at the hustings and to kind of keep everything quite anodyne and quite boring, are actually favouring Keir Starmer rather than Rebecca Long Bailey.
And just finally, Jess Phillips has pulled out, is not attending one of the union hustings today. So I think there's growing speculation that actually she might just cut her losses and drop out.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And thank you for listening.